Listen, everybody, we all know that real estate is the most proven way to build wealth. But why isn't everyone wealthy from real estate then? It's hard to know where to start, and most of the education out there is just complete trash, and you end up investing your money on a series of courses instead of in real estate. That's not how this podcast works. We give you the blueprint to successful real estate investing and bring on guests actually willing to share their secrets. I started my real estate investing journey as a freshman in college when I bought my first duplex and have been in the trenches doing deals ever since. And today, I now own hundreds of millions of dollars of investment property. On this podcast, you will learn what you actually need to know to be a successful active or passive real estate investor. And we'll offer our takes on what's happening today so you can navigate this market and build wealth. I'm Drew Brenneman, and this is the Brenneman Blueprint.
So for today's episode, what I want to do is go back and replay an episode that I put out pretty early on in the podcast. I think I've done a couple of replays before, but really, I only will do this if the episode is something that is really timely and something that I think people need to hear today. And then also came out pretty early, you know, or came out a while ago. So if you're a newer listener, you know, or joined us maybe within the last year, you would have probably missed this episode unless you went back and kind of studied some of the prior ones. But the episode I want to replay today is episode 15, and that was with Jim Voza, who's with CBRE. What Jim Voza does is he specializes in Freddie Mac small balance loans and Fannie Mae small balance loans. So these loans are only on multifamily properties that are five units or more. And the minimum loan amount, I believe, is $1 million. You know, if there's anything said differently by Jim in the episode, go with what he said for sure. Just to talk about how it's helped me a lot, and then I'll say how it's applicable today. And then let's just roll with the episode. But what we did is I had $3 million of equity from my first investor to put into Chicago deals. So we bought three properties that were roughly $10 million in total. But what we were doing is value add deals. So what we were doing is we were acquiring them, doing something to improve the rental income. So on the first two, we just could walk in there day one and raise the rents. The first deal we bought in Chicago was 16 units, 12 three bed, two baths, and 4 2 bed, two baths. And the 3 bed, 2 bath units, they were renting for like $2,600 on average, I'd say. And we knew we could get $3,000 just looking at the market. So that was our whole business plan. And you raise the rents that much without putting in any more money into it. I mean, you're creating a lot of value. You know, if anytime you make a pro forma, if you could just change the rents up $400 a unit, there a lot of value is created. And then like a year and a half later on that deal, it appraised for almost $8 million. So then we put a new, and sorry, that's without knowing the purchase price, that wouldn't be too useful. We paid $5.7 million for it. And then a year or so later, it appraised for $8.6 million. And we put a $6.5 million mortgage on it and pulled out more than we put into it. You know, so we paid $5.7 and then financed $6.5 million. So that was just one of many deals that we did. So then kind of what we did was, so we bought those first three deals, then we refinanced out all of our equity. So then we have $3 million again, you know, or a little more in this case, with how well the first deal went. And then we bought three more deals or whatever the number was. But then we bought another $10 million of property. Then we refinanced all those deals after doing the same thing. We bought another $10 million of property. So now we have $30 million of property. Then we refinanced out the equity on those, the third round of deals. And then we couldn't find any good deals from there. This would have been like in 2018. So interest rates were ticking up. Rates got into the fives, but like the prices didn't really drop much. So it was harder to make deals pencil. So then we just returned the money to our investor and said, you know, we're not finding deals that hit this criteria. And I mean, one thing that's, you know, important in investing is not to be pushing deals and doing deals you shouldn't be doing, because now, you know, he has his $3 million back and is happy with the outcome. Whereas if we just pushed it into some subpar deals from there, you know, maybe nobody would be happy. So that's how we've used the program and why this is so applicable today. And I wanted to replay it, make sure people saw it, is if you're investing in real estate now and you're buying deals, so the financing markets, the banks, the debt funds, the life insurance companies, everybody is really lending conservatively or just has hit the pause button. You know, these banks, these funds, the life insurance companies, they're not getting as many loan payoffs as normal. So then they're not sort of recycling that money. So let's say they have a book of loans, it's however many billions of dollars. And normally what happens is they have a certain amount of loans be paid off in a given year. They make new loans. But right now they don't want to overextend their loan book where they're not getting stuff paid off. They don't want to grow their loans too much because of all this sort of they want to make sure they have enough deposits on hand for the amount of loans they have out is the agency lenders. And so one of the things that really makes multifamily sort of stand on its own as the best asset class is you have access to Fannie and Freddie and also FHA. So if you're doing deals where the loan amounts are $1 to $7.5 million and you're not using this program, you really need to listen to this because this might be where you're getting your next loans from. Where if the bank you normally go to or whatever lender you had been using, quoting really high rates now, or telling you know, hey, we're kind of on the sidelines right now, or don't want to renew a deal, like renew a loan, and they want you to go elsewhere, and this might be where you're going. So wanted to put it sort of out again, in really not much has changed with the program. If we say any rates, obviously this is from like 2021 or start of 2022. So not the rates are obviously higher today than whatever, if that came up in the podcast, but the way the program works for the interest only options, how the loans are sized and the prepay options and just sort of how the program works, that's really unchanged. Without any further ado, with Jim Voza, CBRE, with the Fannie and Freddie Small Balance Program. Kind of the program genesis was there was a need for loans, let's say at that time, $5 million and under, just a streamlined process, keep the origination costs like a streamlined amount. Because I guess prior, if you had a smaller deal, let's call it, I was being quoted as a Fannie, like the options were you can do the whatever the program was called, where it's a $3 million or less loan amount. Right. And then there was some sort of cutoff at $3 million. That was in 2012, what people would talk about.
Right.
So then really that was the point of the program, was we want to fill that.
And I think Freddie Mac obviously was an established multifamily lender at that point,
yeah,
when it launched in 2014, but probably a majority of their loans that they were originating were larger properties, larger loan amounts. And really what wasn't getting addressed were owners of 5 to 50 unit properties that maintained safe, affordable properties for the workforce, which is, you know, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae's mission to help provide affordable housing for the workforce throughout the country. But I think they realized that those smaller properties where majority of the workforce was living, not being addressed. So they put an emphasis on that and obviously took some time to get the program in place and together. But I think they did a very good job doing it. And the program's changed a little bit here and there, as you know, with their requirements. But the amount of affordable units they've financed across the country since the beginning is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, we see those numbers every year, and they have a mission to finance affordable units, and they meet it and blow it out of the water every year. So
yeah,
they're doing what they intended to.
Yeah. And by affordable, that could be like Section 42 housing or just rents that are lower, let's say market rate.
Yes. And really when we say affordable, I mean, there doesn't have to be any Section 8 involved with it. It's just a rental rate that qualifies as affordable in the market you're in.
Yeah. So the program, it's on all like multifamily product types, really. Like I don't want people to think, oh, this is for affordable. This is for like full market rate, and we're not at rates that were deemed affordable in the county either.
Yes. Now, in the small balance program, we finance market rate housing. We finance properties with voucher-based Section 8 tenants or other subsidies or not-for-profits that are providing voucher-based type transactions. When you get into a property with a deed restriction that's got a project-based contract on it, that doesn't fit great in the small balance world for the agencies. But they have their affordable program, which is where that fits well into.
And because where they really are, you know, the goal of having just more affordable housing, and they're creating a real great debt source for, especially like say not in the major markets. If you're in rural Wisconsin or wherever, you know, there's like a few banks that cover that, but then this is a program sort of nationwide. Fannie small banks will basically lend anywhere.
Exactly. So, and that's a very good point. I mean, if we're in a tertiary small market, we have a solid experienced landlord that maintains his property, maintains a safe community for his tenants, and offers affordable rents. If historically that landlord's been struggling to find financing for this property to keep it going, this product that was launched in 2014 is really filled a gap for that investor and that the type of client that Freddie Mac likes to lend to.
Yeah. So then maybe let's dive into the actual program then. And so I guess kind of first thing everyone wants to talk about is rates.
Yep.
But rates change. So then I think probably the best way to describe the rates is they are going to be at least as competitive as the bank you would maybe use, and then oftentimes slightly lower
Right.
And then from there, there's a million options on how you can, or, you know, maybe not a million, but a lot of options on how you can set up your loan with
right.
different fixed rate terms you can pick, fixed rate to adjustable, interest only terms, five different, you know, quite a few different, we printed out the sheet here, but a bunch of different prepay structures.
Right.
You can go full term interest only,
right.
Lower LTV. So then I think let's just dive into the program wherever you want to start.
Yeah, and I'll start with that rate conversation. I mean, you and I see rates all the time. So I put our rates right on par with the most competitive rates, depending on the lending source across the country. I mean, banks, we're right there with them all the time. These rates are competitive for everyone, but they have extra incentives for properties that qualify as affordable. So, and again, this is just looking at a rent roll and what the current's rent are compared to what's affordable in the market. So it doesn't have to be a Section 8 rent. It's just a market right. rent. But as you get affordable rents in place, then all of a sudden they're offering interest rate discounts to make them more competitive.
And what's like the range of discounts somewhere you're talking about?
Those go really anywhere from 15 basis points all the way to 50 basis points, wow. depending on the level of affordability. And depending on the market.
And the way they look at that, this could be a market rate deal. And just they take the, are they looking up that Fannie average rent schedule or what are they looking at?
So there's an affordability test for both. And I think what they're looking at is this affordable for someone at this location that makes 80% of the area median income? Is this rent on the rent roll affordable for someone that makes 60% of the area median income? There's different levels.
Yeah.
If half of the units are affordable to someone making 80%, we get a level one discount. If more than 80% of the units are affordable, we go to a level two discount. And then if we're in the very low income category where it's affordable to someone making 60%, then we even get more discounts.
Okay, nice.
So it's all very property specific. We take that exact rent roll, we put it against an affordability test, and depending on the level of affordability that's calculated, interest rate discounts are available and they're pretty meaningful. So that's the first point on the program is I put our interest rates up against any lending institution's interest rates. We're always right there.
Yeah.
In fact, more competitive than many.
Yeah. Actually, when you were describing that, I was thinking when there weren't actually a lot of times where I'm getting a competing quote where it was, there were just a few moments in time where, you know, if they wanted to, Fannie or Freddie wanted to slow down production, where then I did a bank loan, but really they've been
right.
more competitive. If that's what you're comparing it with, I think that's the best comparison. Cause sure, you could get a lower rate life company loan or something, but we're talking about LTVs that are not
right.
comparable where actually maybe that's the next best place.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. Yeah. So, but you bring up a good point. I mean, not to say a bank's not going to drop their rates and win business if they have a client that they want to keep in house. That happens,
yeah.
obviously, but I put our rates up against anyone's. LTV wise, in standard and top markets, Freddie Mac is routinely 80% on acquisitions and frankly, 80% on refinances right now. That cash out refinance LTV dipped a little bit during the pandemic yeah. period, but we're back up to 80%. So that doesn't mean on a cash out refinance, every loan will qualify for 80%. I mean, we really need to see a value add story. If we're going to do a cash out refinance at 80%, we need to be dealing with an experienced sponsor. We need to have a quality asset. We need to have a safe asset. That's the program parameters, though. Acquisitions and refinance on top and standard, 80%. And then acquisitions in small and very small markets were at 75% loan to value. And then refinances in those markets were going to be at 70%. In top markets right now, minimum underwritten debt service coverage at 1.2 times for acquisitions. That bumps up if it's a cash out refinance. They want a little extra cushion of debt service coverage in there up to 1.25 times.
On today's episode, I have Tyler Haig, multifamily investment sales broker from Colliers. So he's been on the podcast before. He's one of my favorite guests. And what we're going to do today is go through what's going on in the multifamily market in August 2023. And Tyler covers over a dozen markets. So it'll be an interesting conversation hearing about more than just one place. People haven't heard your story. Maybe just give like a brief overview, who you are, what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me back again. I'm a executive vice president with Colliers. I run our Midwestern apartment practice out of Chicago. I'm in about 15 states in the Midwest, from Oklahoma to Ohio, Arkansas to Minnesota. And then I've got a business partner who operates in the Southeast and the Mid-Atlantic and then runs our national business as well.
Awesome.
And we've done a little over $3 billion in sales over the last, you know, call it 15, 16 months.
Nice. Yeah, that's big volume.
Yeah.
It was all like...
It's not growing anymore.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was all 12 months ago.
Yeah, no, you know what? It's been a tough year. You know, people keep talking about the, you know, are we going to have a hard or soft landing? Are we going to be in a recession or not? And I've been joking with my team that the multifamily recession has been going on for the last six to eight months. But we've been on a hot streak lately. I put a deal under contract this morning, which is exciting.
Congrats.
A nice value add deal, very contentious negotiation. But we've probably done, you know, $300 million in sales this year, which is, you know, 10 years ago, you and I talking, it would have been like the greatest thing ever. It's just with the market and the change in the last year and a half, I mean, it's been night and day different. And everything's tough right now.
Yeah, it is. And I think, that's still a lot of volume. I mean, just the markets we cover.
We feel really good about it. But, you know, with all the movement in the rate environment and SBF, and, you know, there's a lot of nervous equity out there. And that's really been the biggest change that we've seen. As it was, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago, you know, you could throw any deal out there and probably get a lot of subscribers to provide equity. And I'll give an example of this later, but, you know, all the institutions are gone. All of our deals right now, there's practically no institutional equity available whatsoever.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
Because I just spoke to someone who was like, yeah, above $5 million, the market's still really strong. I was like, well, but once you get to about $40 million, it just really starts dropping off. Because
yeah.
All those family offices, private equity funds, whatnot, they're looking at real estate equity going, I don't think this isn't, return's not very great right now for the risk. I mean, sadly, you can make 12, 13, 14% doing pref equity. Why take on the common equity risk?
Yeah.
If you're a family office where I'm investing in everything, I got my tech investments, I got stock market, I'm in debt funds, I'm in equity, I'm in, you know, I'm private real estate, hedge funds, private equity. And then you just go, yeah, this makes a pro forma 15% mm-hmm. IRR, but I can just do debt and make 12.
All that institutional equity wants to be on the credit side of the business right now, doing debt. Or, you know, if it is equity, it's pref equity. You know, I had a call this morning with a large national developer who's got a couple great sites they're trying to capitalize, and, you know, they need a $20, $30 million check, and don't really want to go out and raise it, $1 million at a time. So, you know, there are a handful of groups out there that are still providing equity in larger chunks, but, you know, a great example on the buy side would be, we just launched a deal in Greensboro, North Carolina, about, you know, I guess 45 days ago. Had about as much action on that as we've had in anything over the last couple of years. We got 46 offers on this deal.
Nice.
And we did not have one single institutional equity group bid on it. They were all family offices, all private capital. And, you know, half the buyer pool I've never heard of before, you know. And wow. And so that's been a little bit of an interesting change in our business, is when, you know, as a broker, you know, we have to try to mitigate our risks of our clients in these transactions and vet through buyers. And, you know, sometimes people emerge who might be the buyer, but you have no idea who they are, what their track record is. And so it's actually been kind of fun to figure that out and vet through that a little bit. But it's been a challenge, and you have to stick your neck out as a broker when you make a recommendation to go with someone. And on the ground, I've turned into a problem solver. My business partners turned into a problem solver, and we have clients that are, you know, need to, you know, free up cash very quickly. And deals that were supposed to be sold in 2 or 3 years are being sold now to do that. And so, and those are the smart people getting in front of this and not, you know, sitting back like, oh, hey, broker, why would I ever sell this for a six cap today? This is like a four nine or a five cap all day. And so we're still having trouble with sellers moving down to the market. It's all I can do is, you know, give my honest opinion to someone and make them a recommendation. And it's kind of like you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. That we underwrote recently, and my analyst and I were like trying to figure this out, and we're like, how are we going to put that on this? You know, our debt guys, you know, didn't really like it. You had to put like, I think it was like a 50%, cash in kind of deal. And we decided to underwrite to unlevered returns. To get to where we needed to be, because, you know, there are balance sheet buyers in the market. I like your response, with the value add, cause that's what everybody we're doing value add deals with is doing. And the fact of the matter is most people understand that in 2 years or 3 years after you do that, and if you get hit it at the right time, you're going to do really well on that refi and on the back end of it. And so we're just in such a weird place in the market. And the sad thing about all of this is it's kind of artificial. It's been artificially created by the U.S. government.
So, yeah, I mean, your average person on Main Street and your average voter, though, they don't own any multifamily deals. And it's impacted us, you know, heavily, because we're on the tip of the spear in this capital intensive business where you're borrowing money. And so like for us, it's been painful, but for, you know, people on Main Street, what's been painful is, you know, inflation.
Yeah. So I keep reading and hearing the word, you know, rich session, is what's happening. And that, you know, effectively, you know, for a lot of people who are, you know, middle income or below earners, things are going fine. They probably refied their house. They probably have a couple thousand dollars extra in their pocket every month. And it's the people who own assets and have, you know, invested in things in, you know, a artificial market for, I guess there's no other way to put it. It was an artificial market. Rate should have never been at zero. And
yeah, ours went up in the Midwest stuff we got, and then with the Phoenix, ours went up 12%.
Yeah, I've heard Texas is really bad.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and you know, they have a lot of hail, and other things, flooding, depending where you are. I mean, Houston is, along with Florida, is like barely insurable at this point.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's been where, you know, even in those markets where there's not a lot of losses, like what happens in Arizona, like,
yeah,
you know, nothing for that. But
no water.
It's still your. They're the cities that are there are fine with their water.
Yeah.
I can send you stuff if you ever need
know,
it.
I know.
It's these outlying places where they're trying to pull groundwater that they don't have more of or something. But they don't. But so we have like, let's call it like safe properties. We're not in California where there's earthquakes or Florida where there's hurricanes. And we're up 12. Mm-hmm. I mean, these places where,
yeah.
I think you had something with a Florida deal where it was like, went up from 500 to 2,000 a door or something.
I mean, it's not my client. It's my partner's client and my partner's deal. But you know, we were actually just talking about that deal. We're about to get the listing on it. It's a very large transaction. I think the rent growth on it is like, they're up 70%, and they are going to effectively sell this for a break even because their insurance costs have, you know, quadrupled. Their labor costs are up. They've just had expense creep everywhere. And even though they've done everything that they, you know, put out in their thesis to, you know, to execute this business plan for this property, you know, there's been other forces that have, you know, crept into their returns. And, you know, again, it's like that real deal story. I think it's funny to me to a certain degree because I'm out in the market. We're pretty active still. Like we probably have 25 listings that we're launching in July, which is a lot for right now. When, you know, a lot of the rest of the market has been so busy. And so, you know, there's a lot more, I just think there's a lot more problems out there with a lot more groups, and nobody wants to talk about it. And no one's openly ready to say, we got a problem. You know, my expenses were underwritten at 40% and now they're 50%. My rent growth was supposed to be 12% and now it's 4%. You know, I still think there's a shortage of apartment housing. There's plenty of demand, and really the supply side of things in some places is aggressive.
But I don't feel like they're a winner if the price is bad, if you will. Now you are, because at a certain level, if you can close the deal, anybody could just pay the most. So like, what did you win? You just were the person willing to pay the most.
Yeah. I mean, listen, we have such, you know, I was thinking about what you asked me earlier. I mean, we've had situations where, you know, you award the deal, the second place guy gets super pissed, calls your client directly and tries to make a deal. And sometimes they actually does make the deal with your client directly. And then we have to go back to the guy you awarded the deal to and be like, oh, by the way, like someone came in and paid $2 million more just because they wanted it. You know, from a metric perspective, like everyone's underwriting, you know, differently. A lot of people underwrite on a cash and, you know, they look at their cash and cash or their IRR. And I just think a lot of it is building wealth for their kids and their families and creating that massive wealth vehicle. And everyone knows that it's a good time to invest in apartments, even if the capital markets are not in a great place. I mean, would I be buying like 50s and 60s apartment buildings right now? Probably not, because they just are pretty old vintage, right? And things break and they get more costly. But in the next 30 years, I don't think there's going to be a major surplus in housing anywhere. And I think this whole housing affordability, you know, crisis that everyone, it's not a crisis if you just let people build more housing units.
You know, whatever, if there's a lawsuit or something, a slip and fall like that, now you're picking that up.
Yeah. Well, it's the same reason. I mean, it's the reason why people like Arizona, right? It's the same reason why people like Indiana. Indiana's the same way. 2% cap. It's pretty easy to calculate your taxes. I mean, you go to Michigan and you need like a Harvard degree to figure out what the taxes are on every deal.
Yeah, it is.
In general.
Yeah, and it's not great for the country if everyone moves to Florida and the South either. Like we need, you know, it's better if people are spread out. I mean, it will keep the pricing less crazy of things. And it's also just so odd how, from like a weather standpoint, where like, aren't we supposed to be, I mean, global warming and eventually we're going to run out of water and we need the Great Lakes and all this, but the states that are booming the most, it's like the top ones. It's like, I think, what is it? Like Utah is number one or something. And then it's like, you know, it's Florida, it's Texas, it's Arizona, it's Vegas. Like, what about global warming and water and the oceans rising and whatnot? Like, is everyone going to move down there and then in 50 years be like, now we need to move back to Chicago?
I am not negative on many places. Like, I would, personally speaking, I would never invest in a deal in Miami.
Why is that? I'm interested because that is one of the strongest apartment markets,
I know,
housing markets in the entire country.
I know.
I mean, even Goldman Sachs had a report on predicted housing prices for 2023, and only one market was positive, Miami.
You know, people want to, if they're going to take their millions of dollars and invest it somewhere, they want to know it's safe and that it's going to be taken care of and that they are not going to be treated like criminals for investing in the market or, you know, don't get me started on the whole law and order aspect of like our society right now. But, you know, that's one of the biggest disservices. Like Chicago, for instance, if this city just cleaned up all the crime, I think a lot of the capital would actually start to come back. Because
the only problem would be the property tax uncertainty.
Yeah.
And then that's
just kind of over, though, a little bit. I mean,
owning 20 or so properties here, it's not, you don't, you still have, yeah, you went through this first reassessment wave, where now all the buildings got raised, but so many of them got reduced to the Board of Review.
Yeah.
This is, we're in like the second inning of this tax nonsense,
yeah,
in my opinion. And like, you got some buildings that are underassessed, some that are way over. And
well, by the way, he's forcing sales too. I'm selling a building right now that is getting sold for effectively what it cost to build it, because Kagi came in there and, you know, the taxes, you know, 2.5x'd. And, you know, talk about a huge hit to your NOI. I mean, they lost millions of dollars of value because he got a little aggressive on the north side of Chicago.
Well, that's why I'm saying it's more than crime. They need to get tax certainty, even if it was the rates are higher or you're paying more. Like in Chicago, probably the most common, let's say, percent of your income that you're paying in taxes.
Yeah, you're right. LA is the same way. Like, you know, I think the one city actually that is going to probably be a casualty too, for the same exact reason, which is the most obvious one, is San Francisco. I mean, talk about a disaster. Like they completely, I mean, who would have thought that having drug addicts on the street, you know, harassing people would be a bad thing?
It would. So let's leave it there.
Yeah.
So how do people get in touch with you? They want to reach out.
Email tyler.haig@colliers.com, and I'm available on my phone. You can call me at midnight if you want to.
All right, and just look up his phone number.
Yeah,
and shoot him a call in the middle of the night. Sounds good. All right, cool. Thanks for being on. Appreciate
it. Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Super excited for today's guest. I have Bob Knackle, legendary broker from New York City, here today. Welcome, Bob.
Hey, Drew, great to be with you today.
So, as I mentioned, Bob's a commercial real estate broker who sells buildings in New York City. He also told me that on July 16th of this year, he's going to be starting his 40th year in brokerage. So he's been doing brokerage just like about a year or two longer than I've been alive. And then how did your career, I mean, you've had a lot of success, so then I think probably where you just graded it right away, or kind of how did that
No, you don't really know how you're going to do. I knew that I really liked the business a lot, and I knew I was going to work hard at it. I tended to immerse myself in things when I set out to do something. And I think for the first 7 or 8 months, I worked 7 days a week. And, you know, back in the mid-80s, working meant being in the office. If you weren't in the office, you weren't working, because we didn't have computers, we didn't have cell phones, we didn't have any of those things. So if you wanted to work, you had to be in the office. So that meant, you know, driving into the city on Saturdays and Sundays and things like that. But, you know, I knew that I really, really loved the business. The first deal we closed was in March of 85. So it was about 9 months after I had started. And that was a great feeling to get one under the belt. But you know, it was a lot of hard work and a lot of blocking and tackling. And, you know, I had some good fundamentals at the beginning, but, you know, didn't realize that the market was going to be, or that my relative level of success in the business was going to be what it was until many, many years later.
And at what point were, so this working on the weekends, that, how long did that continue for?
Well, it's still going. I still work on the weekends. I think, you know, as a broker, we have two main assets. We have our knowledge and our time, and you're always trying to increase your knowledge, learn more things. I still learn things every day, but you have to use your time as effectively as possible. So I spend a lot of time on the weekend, you know, debriefing on what happened the week before, planning for the week to come. You know, once Monday morning comes at 9 o'clock, so the thoughtful part of the process is done on the weekends, times when you actually can focus.
Yeah, that I'm not surprised to hear that. That's been a common thing that I've heard just from other successful people.
I feel so lucky, because as I say, if you follow me on social media, I chirp this every now and then, is that, you know, real estate for me is not only a career, but it's also my hobby. You know, when I'm not working, I'm either working out or spending time with my wife and my daughter. But if they were to go on a girls' trip for the weekend, I would probably work all weekend. You know, I just really, really enjoy it. And I feel very blessed that I stumbled into a business that I truly love as much as I do.
Yeah, no, I don't doubt that. So that's interesting. I've done the same thing where, yeah, if I don't have my son and my girlfriend's going on a girls trip, I'm doing the same thing where I'm thinking about, you know, I'm not going out on the lake. I'm kind of trying to catch up on work. So I hear that. So I guess kind of as you built, you know, Massey Knackel and your own firm, what did you had hired, I'm sure, a lot of brokers.
Passion is something that gets you through tough times. And no matter how good you are, you're always going to have tough times in the business world. So that passion enables you to work hard enough to push through those tough times. We looked for competitiveness. Real estate brokerage is a very, very competitive business. So we loved people who were athletes and competed, and particularly who played team sports, because real estate brokerage is also a team sport. It's not an individual sport. So that was a good characteristic. And looking for signs of excellence in someone's background, whether it was editor of the school newspaper or captain of the debating team or something that evidenced, you know, excellence in your background. And again, all of these things increase the probability of a successful broker, but certainly didn't guarantee it. And I think that served us really well because we had a great bunch of people. You know, we had guys getting a summer house together in the Hamptons, and people would go on vacation together. And one of our folks would get married, and there'd be 50 people from the company there. So that it created an environment that was had a very, very good culture. I had a lot of great experiences and working on some deals now because of it. And I've just been really blown away by the reach, the quality of the people that are on.
What were you doing to grow the business?
Yeah, well, there are a few inflection points over the history of the firm. You know, when we started out in 1988, the quality and amount of publicly available information was not good. It wasn't a lot of it. What was available wasn't very accurate. So we implemented a geographic specialization to the business. We had one broker working in each neighborhood in Manhattan. Paul and I started in two areas right next to each other, put somebody north of us, somebody south, and grew like a jigsaw puzzle. And then when we had all the territories in Manhattan occupied, we had to make a decision. What do we do? Do we get into office? Do we get into retail leasing? Do we do debt? Or do we go sell buildings in the outer? And we decided to open up an office in Queens. We said, you know, we don't know anything about those other disciplines. We know how to sell buildings. Let's open in Queens. And we did that in 1999. And it was at a time where it wasn't really in vogue to go to the outer boroughs. Most Manhattan brokers thought their shoes would get too dirty if they ventured across the river. So we, you know, we opened up in Queens, and then we opened up in Brooklyn. And had another inflection point occurred for the firm after 9/11. Up till that point, Paul and I had been interviewing everybody ourselves. We saw companies were downsizing. We had a recession going on. We had the terrorist attack at 9/11. And a lot of companies were downsizing. Great quality people were being let go. We did something that was counterintuitive. We went out, hired a director of HR, said, go hire all these people. We had 21 people at 9/11. Within 2 years, we were at 150. It just, the market took off, really rallied very well. The timing was perfect there. And then we had another inflection point when we got to the point where all of our sale territories in New York City were filled. And then we started looking at other markets. We looked at Boston and Philly and Chicago. And what we concluded was that if we went to Chicago, which would have been our next office, we'd have to explain to people who we are in addition to what we could do for them. And we said, we have so many relationships that are very, very good with people in New York. Let's offer them more services. And, you know, we had formed an advisory board at the company. John Fowler, who was one of the F's in HFF, was on our advisory board. He suggested we get into the debt business. So in 2012, we started a mortgage brokerage business. We also got into retail leasing. And so we handle these inflection points differently based on the growth of the firm. But there were certain points you could look back on, point to, and say, hey, you know what, that was a big, big change in how we did things and why we did things the way we did. And fortunately, a lot of those moves we made were very positive.
Yeah, that's interesting. Kind of just sort of really counterintuitive, or it's the opposite of what most all the other companies were doing, where you're growing when things are pulling back. I'd be curious to hear about that, what you guys were doing, how that made you different. Or
yeah, well, we always believed in market presence and having people know you. There are so many smaller properties in New York, and especially because that was the niche we were playing in. You know, you call as many of those people as you possibly can, but it's more important, and I say this all the time, in private capital investment sales, it's not who you know, it's who knows you. So we would put together market reports. Each of our territory agents would write a newsletter about what was happening in their particular neighborhood. We put together a company newsletter that we sent out quarterly. Our distribution got to be over 200,000 of those quarterly. You know, before email really started to get popular, we were sending out over 3 million pieces of mail a year. And I still talk to people who say, yeah, I remember getting all your mail back in the day, that green and white mail. It still left an impression on people because it went out like clockwork. Every month, people were getting a piece of hard mail from us, whether it was a postcard, a market report, comp study, quarterly newsletter. We really believed very firmly in what's referred to today as proof stacking. We didn't know that we were proof stacking back in the day because that term hadn't been coined yet, but we were sending out information about the transactions that we had closed and showing our track record, and it really became like a snowball rolling down a hill. And again, today folks refer to it as proof stacking, but we're doing it before that phrase was a phrase. And just to have all of this information to show that you can do that transaction, you have the capability. You know, a lot of people have that track record, but it's difficult for them to show it. And so we believe that having the hard materials to demonstrate capability and qualification.
So then if we were in a meeting and I was I have a partnership breakup, I want to sell a property, you would be ready to, you already have all your cart examples printed out, just the one pagers or however.
Well, they're all in a book, actually. They're all in a book.
Oh, okay.
And we typically would put a post-it on the similar dynamic situations to the one that we were pitching. And that's actually helpful. You're thumbing through a book of 200 deals, right, pointing to 5 or 10. Again, that's the impression is, hey, these guys have done a lot of transactions. And then you have specific cases where you overcame challenges that are present in the transaction that you're going after at that time.
And how would you define market? I think that's a term I've heard you use before.
Market presence is being known. I think it is. It's a combination of so many different things, Drew. It's making your calls, sending out emails, sending out texts, sending out hard mail, going to networking events, speaking at conferences, just being out and present in the marketplace so that people get to know you. You know, that's such an important part of building trust with people. Certainly, you want to always covet your reputation. Make sure you protect that because you work a lifetime to build a reputation. You could lose it in a blink of an eye. So you want to make sure that you are trustworthy, that people know you. If people know you and like you, they'll talk to you. If they trust you, they'll do business with you. And so, you know, I think that market presence is just being, is trying to be top of mind with people. If you think about it, in Manhattan, for instance, south of 96th Street, there's 27,649 buildings. The average turnover of that stock of buildings over the last 39 years has been 2.6%. Which means on average, when someone buys a building in New York or Manhattan, they own it for 40 years before they sell it. So people don't always transact it. So you want to be the person they think of when it hits them, hey, we should think about selling the building or we need to sell the building. And you look, you know, death, divorce, taxes, partnership disputes, retirement, a number of strategic reasons why people either have to sell or want to sell. And but when they come to that conclusion, you want the first thing for them to think about is, hey, let me call so-and-so. They've been after me. all these years, then, you know, that's the position you want to be in, is to be top of mind with people who are making decisions about whether to transact or not.
Did any of your competitors eventually start doing this the same? Because this sounds easy, folks, but I mean, as a broker, it's got to be really hard to be passing on like these kind of, this especially this example I'm giving, where it's a buyer that you could rep that has money. They literally need to buy a property to defer their taxes, and then you're passing on that. So I wonder, did competitors start copying that, or how did that, what did they?
Yeah, I think there were other firms that tried to implement that and did. And I mean, today there are 14 companies or investment sales divisions that are run by folks who learn the business at Massey Knackel. So today we're competing with a lot of folks that are implementing the same exact kind of approach, but that's what makes it fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I had one of those guys on my podcast, and this James Nelson, his episode comes out this week. And I think he said that he was one of the first hires, but is there two people applied and he wasn't the first choice?
So. That's right. And the guy that we hired actually flamed out in less than a year. And, you know, James went on to do the great things that he's accomplished, and very, very proud of him. You know, I consider him like a little brother in the business, and, you know, he's great.
Yeah. If you learned something from today's show, leave a review and hit that subscribe button wherever you enjoy your podcast. Dive deeper into real estate investing on Brenneman Capital's website, Brenneman.com, where we have numerous free resources and information that can help both active and passive real estate investors. Accredited investors can get started today as a passive investor in our multifamily investment opportunities by hitting the Invest Now button on our website.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of Drew Brenneman and guests as of the date of recording, and do not purport to reflect the views or opinions of Brenneman Capital LLC and its subsidiaries. Views and opinions are provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon or deemed as investment or tax advice or an offer to buy or sell securities. The speaker cannot be held responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of these.